From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Today, Elton John. A new CD box set collects rarities, demos, B-sides, and fan favorites from his long career. We'll listen back to our interview with him from last year after he'd published his memoir. That book was pretty forthcoming about family, addiction, and sexuality, and so was the conversation. He didn't realize he was gay until after he asked a woman to marry him.
I'd never had a sexual experience at all. I didn't have a sex till I was 23. I didn't know anything about it. I presumed that you had to marry a girl because that was the way things were done.
A lot has happened since then. Elton John and his husband now have two children. Also, Justin Chang reviews Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, the new Netflix film starring Viola Davis, with Chadwick Boseman in his final role. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our guest today is Elton John. He personally selected the tracks for a new 8-CD box set spanning his career. It includes rarities, demos, B-sides, and fan favorites. When Terry spoke with him last year, he had just published a new memoir titled Me, which took stock of his life and career. He wrote about his childhood, becoming a musician, songwriter, and performer, how he realized he was gay after he proposed to a woman, how saying yes to a line of cocaine led to addiction, one of several addictions, the rehab program that enabled him to get sober, the health scare that nearly robbed him of his voice, and what it's like to now be married to his husband David and raise their two children. A recent biopic, Rocket Man, was a fantasy version of his life. The book was Elton John's more realistic account.
Elton John, welcome back to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the book. It's a pleasure to have you back on our show.
Thank you, Terry. It's lovely to be back with you.
So the book is a very candid description of your life. Before we get into some of the candid details that you write about in the book, you were in the band early in your career as the keyboard player in Long John Baldry's band. The band was called Bluesology. You tell this really funny story at the beginning of the book where he had just had a big hit. So now he was famous, and you know, young women were coming to the concert and kind of like really getting excited and screaming. Yeah. And he says on mic, he says, why don't you say what he said?
Well, he said, they were grabbing the microphone. He said, if you break my microphone, you'll pay me £50. And I'm going, oh, John, that's not the way to handle this situation.
What did that teach you about stardom and how to handle it?
Not how to handle it.
Because
I got to this point where after Rocket Man came out, which was my first really big hit, about 2 years into my career after Your Song, I got screaming girls at some of my shows. And I just thought that was rather funny because I wasn't David Bowie and I wasn't Rod Stewart and I wasn't Mark Bolan and I wasn't Mick Jagger. But I was at the piano and I got screaming girls. But I thought, I'm not going to. Luckily, they couldn't reach my microphone because I was playing the piano. But you accepted it and you loved it and you just went along with it. I think John didn't know how to cope with it. He just really didn't know how to cope. For all his life, he'd been playing in clubs, playing the blues. And suddenly girls, young girls were screaming at him. And I just think, you know, he just never knew how to handle that.
Of course, also with you, when you had young girls screaming at you and everything, like you were gay, they didn't know that.
No. Well, he was gay, too.
Oh, and he was gay, too. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. So what was it like for you knowing you were gay, knowing they didn't realize you were gay and they were probably having all these like sexual fantasies about you?
Yeah. Well, I didn't worry about it. It's like, well, I'm not interested and you're not. You're interested, but I'm not.
Right.
But it was very sweet and they were very. I've still got a lot of. Most of my audience is a lot of women as well, a lot of girls and a lot of females. And I'm very grateful for that. But I just kind of think that once they did find out, I think a lot of girls still, you know, wanted to mother me and, you know, we can make you straight. We love you. We love you. And it's very touching.
Well, speaking of you and John Baldry, being gay, when you decided you were going to marry a woman when you were in your early 20s, he said to you, John, you're gay, you can't marry her. And what was your reaction? Because I don't think you had acknowledged that to yourself yet.
I hadn't, and I just thought, oh my God. I remember where it was at the club. It was in Carnaby Street, and that's when Bernie and I came home that night, and we were so drunk. And I told Linda, the girl I was going to marry, that I wasn't going to marry her anymore because I'd never had a sexual experience. I didn't know anything about sex. I'd never had a sexual experience at all. I didn't have a sex till I was 23, which was portrayed in Rocket Man. That was the first time. I didn't know anything about it. I presumed that you had to marry a girl because that was the way things were done. But I didn't have sexual feelings for Bernie. I just had great love for Bernie. And I wanted to cuddle him and I wanted to give him a hug. I didn't want to go to bed with him, but I did love him more than I did love Linda. And when he said that, I suddenly start thinking, oh. Because I had no one in my family who was gay. I had no yardstick to measure my gayness on, except I worked for Long John Baldry for so long. And he was so, when I look back now, he was so outrageous. And I didn't know anything, didn't think he was gay. I didn't know about anything. I didn't know about it. I was so naive. So that night, thank God, the epiphany came that night and I went home and, you know, dodged the bullet, as it were. But I still didn't have sex for a couple of years, two or three years later.
It's remarkable that you could be like a rock musician and remain a virgin until you were 23. You might be the only person.
Well, a lot of rock musicians go into rock music to pull girls. They go. That's one of the big attractions. Well, we can play on stage and we can flirt with the girls, and then we can go backstage and then we can have them. We can take them home and we can have sex with them. That was never my motive. I was just wanted to play music. Sex wasn't anything I was thinking about. I was just wanting to play music. I was so obsessed with music. Nothing entered my head apart from that.
You said you wanted to play music, but on the other hand, you write that, you know, early on, like when you were a sideman with John Baldry, that you thought what you really wanted to do was write songs. And you had auditioned for Liberty Records, and they told you you were not ever going to be a pop star. You weren't pop star material. No. So did you think, like, you really weren't cut out to be a like maybe they were right that you weren't cut out to be a performer, that your job should be behind the scenes or as a sideman?
Well, I was getting fed up with Long John Baldry playing to cabaret people who were eating chicken and chips and not caring about the music. And I thought, I didn't become a musician for this. Maybe I'd written a couple of songs for Bluesology that were recorded, and the lyrics were awful, but I wrote the melody. And this audition for Liberty Records was just, I thought, maybe I can be a songwriter. I had no intentions of being a Elton John superstar or whatever. I just thought, maybe I can write music. I went to the audition. I said, I do sing, but I don't sing much. But I can write songs, but I'm a terrible lyricist. And hence, he gave me the envelope, which was, you know, could have been any envelope. And it was Burner's lyrics, which I read on the train going home. I didn't have any ambitions at that time to become someone who made their own records and became a star. I just thought, well, maybe if I leave the band, I can become a songwriter. And that'll be fun. And I'm still in the music business. So it was just part of the process of the serendipity that happened to me, that if I hadn't gone to that meeting, I wouldn't be sitting here talking to you now. And then you look back and think, how did I have the courage to go to that meeting when I was chubby? I had no self-esteem. I was shy. But anything was better than playing to people who were eating chicken and chips while you were playing.
You said you had no self-esteem or low self-esteem. Were the costumes that you, like the crazy clothing that you wore, the big glasses, all that, was that in part armor to cover up your low self-esteem? Like something
no,
to call it?
No, it was because in my teenage years, I wasn't allowed to wear anything fashionable at all. No pointed-toed shoes, no chisel-toed shoes, no fashionable coats. So when I actually left home and started, I think that was the leap, leaving home and beginning to earn my own wage and keeping myself and supporting myself, that I decided to live my teenagers in my 20s. And I made up for lost time pretty quickly. And I went hell for leather for it. And I just had such a great time because I was cocooned in boring clothes.
It sounds like a lot of your childhood years weren't great. Your parents bickered all the time. Your mother remarried, and you liked your stepfather. But they bickered all the time. They got married when she was 16 and he was 17. Yeah. You wonder if they ever should have been together in the first place. And your mother sounds like she was a very moody and frequently angry person who could hold a grudge. And you even describe how when you don't remember this, but I think it was an aunt who told you that when your mother was toilet training you, she'd beat you with a hairbrush until you were bloody, and she'd beat you until you used the potty.
Right.
So is that kind of typical of what your childhood was like?
But that was my mother who did that. My father and my mother should never have gotten married. They got married very quickly after the war, which a lot of people did. They were totally unsuited to each other. My dad was in the Air Force and was away a lot. My mum worked very, very hard in shops and also later in life at the Royal Air Force as well. And I was the product of, I don't know how many times they must have had sex. I don't think they must have had sex very often, but I was the product of their marriage. The 50s was an incredibly tough time to grow up in. It was after the war. It was very conservative. So if you were in a marriage and you wanted to get out of it, it was very tough to get out of it because divorce was frowned on socially. And I can remember my Uncle Red coming when my parents were thinking of getting divorced, saying, "You can't get divorced. What will the next door neighbours say?" That was what it was like. I knew nothing about sex, nothing. I was seen and not heard. Children were seen and not heard. I had the wonderful upbringing with my grandmother, and my mother could be so much fun, but she was mercurial. And they were like oil and water, the two of them. The nice thing about it is that they got, when they did get divorced, and my mother found Fred and my dad found Edna, is that they found the love of their lives. And that I'm very happy about. But the bit in between was hard to take because I dreaded my dad coming home because there would be a row immediately. And then I would retreat to my room, look at my books, look at my records, look at my toys. And funnily enough, I found love of inanimate objects because inanimate objects, which I kept in pristine condition, couldn't harm me or talk back to me. So I always loved collecting things.
What did you collect as a kid?
Books, records, toys, dinky toys, but mostly records and books, which I never lent out to anybody because I still have my books.
Well, you became an obsessive shopper later in life, and you collected everything.
I'm an addict. It was the instigation of being an addict, but it was because I felt safe with the objects and not with my parents, and so, and it gave me a determination. With my dad not wanting me to be anything to do with rock and roll when Elvis Presley came in, that I would be determined to prove to him that. My mother, who took my side and said, yeah, you should do what he does and let him do the music because he loves it, and was very supportive. My dad, of course, hated it. And I've been trying to prove to my dad that it's been okay ever since. So it gave me the determination to make something of myself. And it's just prolonged in my life. He's been dead for over 30 years, and I'm still kind of doing that. It's like, well, Dad, I hope you're proud now. And it's crazy.
He was an amateur trumpet player, wasn't he?
He was a trumpet player in a band, yeah.
Yeah, so why was he so set? I realize he didn't like rock and roll, but still he must have appreciated that you were such a talented musician, and you were studying classical music, too, at a conservatory.
I know. He just considered, there was an expression in called wide boy, which meant crook. He said, if I became a, Elton is, my mother read the letter to me, it's in a thing called Tantrums Neuron. Elton would become a wide boy if he carried rock and roll is just, there's no future. He wanted a solid future for me in a bank or in the Air Force or doing a proper job. It was all down, you grew up in the 50s, you knew what it was like. It was, when Elvis came, it was a revolution. It was a social revolution and people were horrified. And people who in England were horrified who had, conservative opinions of what was good and what was bad. That if I became a rock and roller, my life would fall apart. To a certain extent, he was right.
You could say that, but it also... let's face it, you've had an amazing life. He must have been so proud once you became famous and hopefully a little embarrassed that he tried so hard to discourage you from doing what you do.
No, not really. He never came to my shows. He never wrote a letter saying, well done.
He didn't even try to capitalize on your fame? Like, that's my son.
No. He had four other sons that he had with his married to Edna, and he was a tactile father to them and loving. He just, I've done so much therapy and rehab, and I just look back on it and saying this was an unfortunate meeting of two people who should never have met each other.
Just curious, how much do you think of that is like the music, that it was rock and roll, and do you think any of that estrangement was because you were gay?
I think he was a musical snob, yeah.
Okay.
I grew up, I'm so grateful for, I always had music in the house, Terry. I grew up with, Nat King Cole, Frank Sinatra, George Shearing.
This is great music.
All great music. All from America, obviously, but great music. When I was like 9 years old, I think I got Songs for Swinging Lovers as my Christmas present by Frank Sinatra. And I loved George Shearing. He was a jazz player pianist who was blind, who came from Pinner, where I came from. When I first became successful in the early 70s, I went to New York and I phoned him and I said, thank you. I grew up with your music. And it was fantastic. And I was only 6 or 7 years old when I heard your music, but I loved it. And it made me want to play the piano like you, although I couldn't play as well as you. But I was very grateful to the music I had. But when Elvis Presley came knocking on the door, and Little Richard and Jerry Lee Lewis, who started jumping on the piano, then that was what I wanted to do.
And that's kind of what you did. Okay, let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. If you're just joining us, my guest is Elton John. He has a new memoir called Me. We'll be right back after a short break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Elton John. He has a new memoir called Me. It seems to me in London that there was a kind of community of gay musicians who weren't necessarily out to the public, to their listeners, but that people in the music world knew, and that it wasn't as bad a closet as some closets were, because there was this community of people. And so like you and John Baldry and later Freddie Mercury. There's David Bowie being gender fluid. Did you feel like there was a community there that was a kind of safe place?
Well, there was a gay community that I got introduced to. My manager, John Reed, was gay, and he was the head of Tamla Motown Records in England.
And he was your first boyfriend, too.
Yeah, and Tony King was the first real big gay influence, who's in the book a lot, who's my best friend and still works for me. And he was the most exotic creature I'd ever met when I first met him. He had beads on and feather boas, and I went, what's that? I want to be like he is. There was a gay community in London, but it still wasn't, people weren't out. But when I moved in with John Reed, Tony King said, you might as well hang a flag out the window and say you're gay right now, because John was, a big fixture on the London gay scene. And I had no qualms once I'd done the dirty deed in San Francisco with John Reed. Of course, that set the floodgates open, and I enjoyed the sex, and I knew it was a relief to find out that I wasn't going to die, and it was great, and it was fun, and it wasn't sordid, and it was lovely. Everything I was told about sex before was horrible. From that point on, I flourished as a sexual human being, but there was still wasn't. I mean, in the 60s in England, you could still go to jail for being a gay. People used to go to North Africa. People could afford it, used to go to North Africa and have sex, like Joe Orton and people like that, from comedians like Kenneth Williams. They all went to North Africa because, the only sort of gay clubs were available, there weren't any gay. People went to public toilets, and people like Sir John Gielgud were arrested in public toilets for having sex. There were nowhere for gay people to go except maybe a few little clubs upstairs in Soho. It was the beginning of a gay scene in the early 1970s. There was a club called Yours and Mine, which David Bowie took me to, and I'd never been to a gay club in England before, and that was fun. But I never had I never lived a lie about being gay. John and I were living together in an apartment, then we lived together in a house. We went to Los Angeles and played the Troubadour Club. We went to a gay club on Santa Monica Boulevard. There was a little gay community, but English entertainers have always been very flamboyant, and I think it's because of the music hall tradition that we have in England, and so we've always dressed up, and so there's always been that, Mick Jagger, Mark Bolan, David, Rod Stewart, Freddie Mercury later. It's just a tradition, and, I don't think people cared, and also we had radio programs that were very, very funny with blatantly gay humor in it. And so England had a very sense of the gay, but I'm quite a blokey gay guy. I like sport, I like football, I like things like, so, but I had no qualms about being gay. And it was just a relief to know what I was.
So it's interesting that you and Freddie Mercury were friends, and there have been biopics about both of you in the past year. Tell us a little bit about what the friendship was like and what he was like offstage.
Well, I met Freddie because John Reed, my manager, managed Queen. And Freddie was one of the most exotic people I've ever met in my life. He was a Parsi. He, you know, he came from Madagascar and had a huge mixture of different blood. And he was exotic, and he was funny, he was brilliant, he was incredibly creative, he was innovative, and he had the best sense of humour. And one of the best, if you're a friend of mine, you have to have a great sense of humour. And we used to hang out a lot together at clubs in London, in Monkbury's, which was a nightclub, not a gay club, but a nightclub. And because John managed them, we used to see a lot of each other. And he just made me laugh. And, you know, I love creative people like that. I like people who have a sense of humor about themselves, and Freddie did. And so it was just always a joy to hang out with him. There was never a dull moment with Freddie.
Elton John, speaking with Terry Gross last year. A new 8-CD box set spans his career and is titled Elton Jewel Box. After a short break, they'll talk about his addictions to alcohol and cocaine and how he got sober, which he wrote about in his 2019 memoir. And Justin Chang reviews Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, streaming on Netflix. I'm David Bianculli, and this is Fresh Air.
Neubauer Family Foundation supports WHYY's Fresh Air and its commitment to sharing ideas and encouraging meaningful conversation. Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for small businesses with an automated virtual receptionist and mobility features to run their businesses from anywhere. More at OOMA.com. And from Workday, committed to delivering quick insights to help finance teams plan for what's next. Workday, the finance, HR, and planning system for a changing world. Learn more at workday.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Let's get back to Terry's interview from last year with Elton John. He has a new hand-picked 8-CD collection from his career titled Elton Jewel Box. When Terry spoke with him, he had just published his memoir. It was, in part, about how his addictions to alcohol and cocaine affected his personal and professional life and how he got sober.
How were you introduced to cocaine?
I was in a recording studio in Colorado at Caribou Ranch, and I saw my manager, John Reed, sniffing something. Now, I was very naive up to the point. I didn't even know what marijuana was. I didn't know my band smoked marijuana. I'd never smoked marijuana. And I don't know what made me say. I said, "What is that?" And he was said he was quite embarrassed. He said, "It's cocaine." I said, "What does it do?" He said, "Makes you feel good." And I said, "Oh, well, I'll have a go." Why I said that, I don't know. Anyway, I had a line of cocaine, which I threw up immediately afterwards because it made me feel nauseous and sick, and it was horrible. And then I After I threw out, I said, can I have another one? Now, why on earth would anyone who needs sane, who was compass mentis, would want another line of cocaine after it made you throw up? But I did. The thing with cocaine, it's very speedy, so it made me talk. And I was quite a shy person, so I thought, this is the drug that can open me up and make me feel relaxed and be able to talk to people. And of course, it was fool's gold. And that was the start of a love-hate relationship with it for 16 years, basically.
Did you think that it would make you more creative in your music, either in writing or performing?
No, but it was an aphrodisiac for me. But on the other hand, it's the aphrodisiac that couldn't perform. This was the drug that made me feel horny, but I couldn't do anything about it.
is that why you describe yourself as having become something of a voyeur?
Yes.
Kind of setting up scenes and watching?
Yeah, I became the Federico Fellini of sex scenes. I'd like to watch.
Yeah, and you say that in the book.
And I think that's probably why I didn't get HIV and I didn't get AIDS in the 1980s, because I didn't participate as much as watch.
Oh, that's really interesting. So in some ways it saved your life.
It did. Cocaine nearly killed me, but it saved me as well, because I liked to watch and it fulfilled my fantasies. So I didn't really participate in much sex.
And that was before you even knew about HIV?
Yeah. And then, of course, it happened so quickly, the terror of it all. And then, the New York Times, the stories, and people, John Reed's personal assistant, Neil Carter, died of AIDS very quickly. People started, that I knew, started dying, and it was terrifying.
Did you ever fear that cocaine and alcohol were turning you into, like, the stereotype of the spoiled, entitled rock star?
Yes, of course, and that's what made it even worse. I mean, when Ryan White was in Indianapolis dying for that week, which I was there for,
people's memories, Ryan White was a boy who had hemophilia and got AIDS through a blood transfusion, and became aware of him,
and I
you
befriended
knew he was
the family.
A fan, you befriended the family.
I knew the family, and for the last week of his life, along with a lot of other people who were friends of the family, I was there in Indianapolis at the hospital, kind of being Jeannie White, his mother's secretary. But I used to come home to the hotel, and the thing about drugs is I always wouldn't ask for help because I knew I had a problem, and I knew my behavior was reprehensible. And I came home to the hotel in Indianapolis, and I would be so ashamed that these people who had been through hell, including Ryan himself, who never complained about it, his family, who had been treated or ostracized by people in their community, forgave their people. I mean, the forgiveness and the Christianity involved in their actions, no hatred, no... It was unbelievable. I came home and I think, I complain here about I don't like the wallpaper, I don't like the furniture. And I said, what kind of person have I become? I've become the most despicable, horrible person. I complain about everything in my life. I'm so blessed in my life. These people have lost their son or losing their son, who has never complained about being the most unfortunate man in the world by contracting HIV through a blood transfusion. And here am I looking at everything and complaining about it. And I said, I really despise myself. And 6 months after Ryan died, I was sober.
You wanted to go into rehab and found that a lot of the rehab clinics wouldn't take you because they handled people with single addictions, and you had several. You had a food addiction, a cocaine addiction, an alcohol addiction.
Yeah.
And so the place that you did go to was like a general hospital in Chicago with no fancy amenities. It wasn't like rehab for celebrities or anything. And it sounds like that was pretty humbling for you, but very productive.
It was exactly what I needed. There were no celebrity rehabs then. There were no rehabs with televisions and things like that. I'm totally against those kind of things. I was at boot camp. I got up at 6 o'clock in the morning. I shared a room. I had to make my bed. I had to work a washing machine, which I didn't know how to do. And I worked really, really hard. I went in kicking and screaming, ready to get well, but also... I had a problem with authoritarianism, and I at one point left and sat on the steps outside the hospital with my suitcase, crying, thinking, what are you doing? You're going, where are you going to run to now and behave like this yet again? So I went back, and I ate humble pie. You have to have, humility to get sober, and I, you know, I needed humility, and I listened, and I listened, and I listened, and I've gradually, it dawned on me, and I really enjoyed my point in term in rehab, because I thought I was the only person that took drugs and did what I did. And of course, listening to people in group therapy saying, I did this, and I think, oh, you did? How fabulous. Then I'm not the only person that did this. So I didn't feel alone anymore.
You almost left rehab because, well, one of the reasons why anyways, was when it got to talk of a higher power, when it got to, as you describe it, the God talk, you felt like that is just like not for me.
Yes.
And you really thought seriously about leaving. So I'd like to know what upset you so much about the God talk, and if you were able to find a way into that talk and kind to turn it toward who you were.
Well, the God thing, I was angry at the God. For me, represented, you know, a punishment. You know, God will punish you for doing this. God will punish you for doing that. I hated the word God. And I was, you know, I really resented the word God. And then someone said to me, listen, do you believe in something greater than yourself? And I said, of course I do. You know, there's been so many things in my life that have happened by chance or just, you know, decisions I've made that have been prompted by something inside of my soul. Of course, I only have to look up in the sky to believe in something greater than myself. Or I'll walk in the field or look at a mountain. And they said, well, then that's it. Use it. Say higher power. And I said, oh, God. And I went, I can do that. I can do that. It doesn't have to be the punishing God that I, you know, learned at Sunday school. It can be a higher power that, you know, sends me messages. And I accepted that, and I came to terms with that, and that was really very important for me.
Well, let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk a little bit more. If you're just joining us, my guest is Elton John. He has a new memoir called Me. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Workday, committed to delivering quick insights to help finance teams plan for what's next. Workday, the finance, HR, and planning system for a changing world. Learn more at workday.com. And from Progressive Insurance, committed to offering a streamlined shopping experience where home and auto can be bundled together. Now that's Progressive. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE.
This is Fresh Air, and if you're just joining us, my guest is Elton John. He has a new memoir called Me. I'm just thinking about the disconnect. I'm thinking about the disconnect between being on stage and having, like, thousands of people, like, screaming for you. Mm-hmm. At a stadium, tens of thousands of people screaming for you. And then being off stage and having to contend with your own problems, the things that you don't know how to do, your own insecurities and your own failings and your own extremes and everything. It seems like that must be really hard to connect, like the famous person who's so beloved and wonderful on stage, yeah, with the flawed person who's off stage.
And that's why you escape into drugs or alcohol, and you just block it out. You block it out until the problem or the thing you're facing becomes such a monumental thing that you explode with rage. And that's the way I handled confrontation. I just blocked it out. I didn't deal with it until I had to deal with it. And then it was a very, very uncomfortable and painful procedure all the time. And I kept doing it time and time again. I hated my addiction. I hated the way I behaved. I hated how I treated people. I hated what I'd become. But I'm grateful that I had it, because then I learned how to become who I am now. And I'm proud of who I am now. I like who I am. I'm 29 years old, because I started to be a good person, or start to try and be a good person, or to behave properly when I was 43. And I know I was always a nice, kind person, but, you know, drugs bring out the darkness in you. The recovery, it wasn't when I was on drugs that was horrible. It was when I was off drugs you know, the come down from it.
Right.
Alcohol is a major depressant. And I was drinking a bottle of Johnny Scotch Black, Johnny Walker Scotch, Johnny Walker Black Scotch every day. Neat. And so no wonder I was angry. No wonder I was, you know, alcohol is a huge depressant.
How could you write songs that way?
Don't know. The only thing that was the constant, Terry, was that throughout all of this, I still wrote songs because music was, again, saved my life. I love touring. I love writing the songs. I love recording, and sometimes not in the best circumstances and not in the fitness that I should have been in or the right state of mind. But it saved my life. If I'd have been the drug addict that I was and I'd just become a recluse and done nothing for 10 years, I wouldn't be here. I'd have OD'd. But because I loved, and I didn't take drugs constantly all the time, I would stop for 9 months. But whenever you go back to something you love, like cocaine, it gets worse every time you relapse and you take more. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the fact that I love the music, that also helped save my life by touring, making the records. I just still love the music. So it would remind me of how great my life was without the drug. And I think I will get well. And then, you know, the madness of it all is, while I was thinking that, I'd be taking yet another line of cocaine. I will get well. Here's another line. I would have seizures in the middle of the night.
Yeah.
I would have seizures and people would find me on the floor and put me to bed. 20 minutes later, I'd be up doing cocaine again. I was blue from seizures. And I would put me into bed and say, we got to call the doctor. I said, no, I'll be fine. When they got out the door, I got the cocaine out again. I started doing it again. These seizures were horrible. They were really distressing. And that's how mad and how dangerous my addiction was. And I look back on it with sheer horror. And
Well, thank goodness you've been sober all these years.
29 years now. It's been wonderful.
It's a long
and
time.
I've learned so much.
So you're married. You have two children now. How long ago did you know you wanted to be a father? Because I'm thinking having the parents that you had wasn't the greatest role models sometimes.
No.
Like if you don't have great parents, it doesn't speak well for the nuclear family and you might not want one.
I never wanted to be a father. I never wanted to have children until I went to the Ukraine on a visit for the Elton John AIDS Foundation with David to an orphanage in Ukraine. And a young boy there who was 18 months old called Lev levitated towards me. Literally, he just jumped into my arms. And I carried him around for an hour and a half at the orphanage. He would not leave my side. He had a brother there called Artemis, who was HIV positive. And we stayed in the orphanage, and we were giving money to the orphanage and supporting them. And then I did a press conference. And after we'd done everything that we had to do, and one of the questions was, this little boy seems to be, who is now sitting on David's lap while I'm answering the question, this little boy seems to have been attracted to you. Would you ever think of adopting him? And I went, you know what? I've never, ever thought of adopting anybody, really, and this kid has stolen my heart. I would love to adopt him. Well, in the Ukraine, I was too old to adopt anything. I was gay. And that was another strike against me. I was too old. The Ukrainian laws was, you know, ex-Soviet laws, which was so, you know, so anti-gay and everything like that. But we tried. Even the adoption laws in Britain weren't great. And we tried for about a year and a half to adopt this boy and his brother. And at the end of the day, it became a national press thing where the press would go out and go to the, you know, find out who his mother was and his father was. And it became, you know, a farce. And David and I sat down and said, listen, the thing that's become more important now is to get these boys out of the, we can't adopt them. But we have to get them out because after a certain time, if you don't have tactile love, you know, it leaves a scar on you. And I said, we've got to get these boys out. They had a grandmother. We got them out to the grandmother in Donetsk, where they came from. And we surreptitiously looked after them. David then said to me, well, what do you think this boy was telling you? And I said, you know, my higher power, or God, whatever you want to call it, was telling me that it's nonsense. He was telling me, yeah, you can be a dad. You would love me. You'd be a good dad. And I said, I'd never thought that before. So David said, what do you want to do? And I said, well, you know, it's going to be hard to adopt. Let's have our own kids for a surrogate. So David did all the investigation, all the hard work, and we found a surrogate. We found an egg donor. And to cut a long story short, we had two children in 2 years from the same surrogate and the same egg donor, Zachary and Elijah. And again, serendipity plays a big part. If I hadn't gone to that orphanage, I would not have had children. And so that boy was telling me something. It was a messenger from the angels or whatever, and I truly believe that. And last year was wonderful because we got to meet them again and their grandmother, and it was so touching. We were in Kiev, and they walked in, and Lev came straight up to me, burst into tears. I burst into tears, and it was the greatest thing in the world. And they're just wonderful boys, and they're flourishing. Their grandmother's doing a wonderful job. We surreptitiously look after them still. We care about them. And but it's a wonderful story because those boys made me a father.
I want to thank you so much for talking with us. It's really been such a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you so much. It's been lovely to talk to you. Thanks.
Elton John speaking with Terry Gross last year. The new 8-CD box set, Elton Jewel Box, collects rarities, demos, B-sides, and fan favorites from his career.
It's a little bit funny, this feeling inside. I'm not one of those who can easily hide. I don't have much money, but boy, if I did, I'd buy a big house where we both could live. If I was a sculptor, but then again, no, or a man who makes potions in a traveling show. I know it's not much, but it's the best I can do. My gift is my song, and this one's for you. You can tell everybody this is your song. It may be quite simple, but now that it's done, I hope you don't mind. I hope you don't mind that I put down the words how wonderful life is while you're in.
After we take a short break, Justin Chang reviews Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, which begins streaming today on Netflix. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. The actor Chadwick Boseman died of cancer in August at the age of 43, not long after he finished shooting the movie Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Now streaming on Netflix, the movie stars Viola Davis as the famous blues singer Ma Rainey and was adapted from August Wilson's play. Our film critic, Justin Chang, says that Boseman's final screen performance ranks among his very best.
One reason Chadwick Boseman was such an extraordinary actor was his ability to command the screen without hogging the spotlight. His presence was so quietly magnetic that even when he played real-life heroes like Jackie Robinson and Thurgood Marshall, or fictional ones like King T'Challa in Black Panther, he still seemed like the most self-effacing of movie stars. But Boseman could also go big, like when he took on James Brown in the musical biopic Get On Up, and gave his most electrifying performance until now. It's devastating that Ma Rainey's Black Bottom is the last new Bozeman movie we'll ever see. This excellent adaptation of August Wilson's 1982 play from the director George C. Wolfe and the screenwriter Ruben Santiago Hudson is both a precious parting gift and a punch in the gut. Even more than in Get On Up, Bozeman holds nothing back. He empties himself out on screen. He plays Levy, a gifted and ambitious trumpet player, struggling to forge his way in a white man's world. Or in this case, a white man's recording studio, where most of the movie takes place. It's a sweltering hot day in 1927 Chicago, and the pioneering Southern blues singer Ma Rainey, played by a superb Viola Davis, is planning to record some of her most popular songs. Ma's name may be in the play's title, but she isn't the main narrative focus here. Much of the story unfolds while the four musicians in her band are waiting for her to show up at the studio. During their rehearsal session, Cutler, the guitar and trombone player, played by Coleman Domingo, wants to stick with their usual arrangement for a particular song, but Levy wants to use a new, edgier version that he composed. It doesn't take long for the arguments to start and the egos to emerge.
What is you? I don't see your name in lights.
Oh, I just play the piece, whatever they want. I don't criticize other people's music.
I ain't like you, Cutler. I got talent. Me and this horn, we's tight. If my daddy had a known I was gonna turn out like this, he would've named me Gabriel. I'm gonna get me a band and make me some records. I done give Mr. Stutterman some of my songs I wrote, and he say he gonna let me record them when I get my band together. I just got to finish the last part of this song. I got style.
Oh, everybody got style. Style ain't nothing but keeping the same idea from beginning to end. Everybody got it.
Everybody can't play like I do.
For all his outward swagger, Bozeman later lays bare the anguish beneath Levy's self-assured grin. In a spellbinding monologue about his Southern childhood, he reveals the acts of violence that were committed against his family by a gang of white men. He's witnessed unspeakable horrors and fought hard for his shot at success, and he's not about to let anyone stand in his way. Not even Ma Rainey herself, when she finally shows up at the studio. Viola Davis, who won an Oscar for her work in another Wilson adaptation, Fences, is magnificent here in the kind of full-throated diva showcase she's rarely taken on. Becoming Ma Rainey required quite the transformation. Davis wears a padded rubber suit and sports a mouthful of gold teeth, and her vocals are supplied by the singer Maxanne Lewis. But the performance never feels needlessly flashy, and Davis's best moments are the ones in which she shows us Ma Rainey's anxious, calculating side. When she stops the recording session because no one's brought her the bottle of Coke she always insists on before singing, she isn't just causing a fuss. She knows exactly what she's worth and how much power she commands in a predominantly white male industry, and she's determined to push herself right up to that line without crossing it. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom is one of 10 plays in August Wilson's epic Pittsburgh cycle, and the only one that isn't actually set in Pittsburgh. Wilson's insights into the complexities of 20th century African-American experience cemented his reputation as one of this country's greatest dramatists. Notably, the filmmakers haven't opened up the material in the manner of so many stage-to-screen adaptations. If anything, they've ruthlessly tightened the play and pared it down to essentials. Wolfe directs at a furious clip. The sets are spare, even drab, which has the effect of focusing your concentration on the performances. And while Bozeman and Davis are the stars of the show, every actor gets a chance to shine, including Michael Potts as the bass player Slow Drag, and Glenn Turman reprising his role as the pianist Toledo from a 2016 revival. At the heart of the play is the bond between Levy, a fictional creation, and Ma Rainey, a real-life figure. The two are antagonistic by nature. Levy keeps trying to put his own stamp on Ma's music, and he makes the mistake of trying to seduce her young girlfriend, played by Taylor Page. But Levy and Ma are also kindred spirits. They're both trying to make authentic, commercially viable art within a system bent on exploiting their talents. But Levy doesn't have Ma Rainey's experience or her knack for self-preservation, and the weight of his past trauma ultimately proves too much to overcome. The climax is haunting beyond words. We're seeing a man peering into an abyss, played by an actor who knew his own life was slipping away. Chadwick Boseman's last moments on the screen are among his darkest and also his finest.
Justin Chang is film critic for the LA Times. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, starring Chadwick Boseman and Viola Davis, is now streaming on Netflix. On Monday's show, Michael J. Fox talks about his new memoir, No Time Like the Future, An Optimist Considers Mortality. It's about his recent life and how it's been affected by Parkinson's disease, which he was diagnosed with in 1991 at the age of 29. At the time, he was famous for the hit sitcom Family Ties and the international movie blockbuster Back to the Future. I hope you can join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer today is Charlie Kyer. Our technical director and engineer is Andre Bentham, with additional engineering support by Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Teresa Madden, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Kayla Lattimore. Our associate producer of digital media is Molly C.V. Nesper. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. For Terry Gross, I'm David B. Cooley.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Workday, committed to delivering quick insights to help finance teams plan for what's next. Workday, the finance, HR, and planning system for a changing world. Learn more at workday.com. And from Crown, with Barack Obama's A Promised Land, the first volume of his presidential memoirs. Obama reflects on his life and early years in office. A Promised Land is out now wherever books and audiobooks are sold.